everything is relative.
Thanks. Actually, the emphasis here is going to be on the other, and Brad will talk mainly about the white dwarfs. First of all, I just want to thank Lars for inviting me here. It was a pleasure to come and be here, enjoy the good weather. And at the same time, on behalf of Raja, I'd like to thank for Raja, Fred, for Fred inviting Raja here, because Raja forgot to say that in his talk, and he told me I had to say that. So here's the people that are involved in some way in this work, and this is sort of like a black hole that keeps accreting. We could add another name down here. Jared Hurley has recently joined us, and he's, some of the simulations that he showed you yesterday were in fact in support of some of the work. I won't go through, but I think you'll recognize at least some of the names and what their contributions to this work has been. So, sort of following along what Mike Rich said yesterday, I guess it's sort of presumptive of me to try and say why we want to study globular clusters, but here's a number of the reasons, many of which Mike mentioned yesterday. Oldest stellar populations known, early phases of galactic star formation, lower limit to the age of the universe, exquisite tests of stellar evolution theory, and these are very dynamical systems, and they're certainly, as Jared showed yesterday, and as we all know well, they're certainly factories for production of exotic stars, and Allison certainly talked about that this morning. What I thought I would do in this talk, since there's lots of theoreticians here, I thought that I would just give you some quick ideas of some of the things which we're doing in globular clusters without going into too many details, and in the next few days I'll be happy to talk to anybody about any aspect of what we're doing. Now, much of what I'm going to say is going to be related to this particular globular cluster, and this is M4, for which we've spent a lot of time recently trying to understand it, and I think you're going to be dreaming about M4 for the next few nights, because many of my slides are going to have M4 in the background, so you'll definitely get to recognize it, as you'll see, and it may become not only a dream, but perhaps even a nightmare. Okay, so first of all, just by way of introduction, where is M4 located with respect to the galaxy? And here it is as Scorpius gets filled in, and there's M4, close to Antares, but not in space. It's much behind Antares. But the thing I wanted to show you with this little diagram is that, at least in projection, an actual on parts of it or its orbit, it comes relatively close, within a few kpc of the galactic center. It's in a dirty, dusty region, so there's lots of extinction in the cluster. There's probably differential extinction across the face of the cluster. In fact, as Lando showed that a few years ago. And probably M4 has been heavily modified over the years by its orbit and its proximity to the galactic center. And we're going to see, in fact, that is exactly the case. So when you look at M4 from our position somewhere out here at the sun, is a little bit of a cartoon, but it gives you the idea. There's lots of ugly stars along the way, some of which we're interested in, and some of which we're not interested in, or at least for a particular problem. And there's probably at least four components along the line of sight. There's the disk, there's the thick disk, there's the cluster itself, of course, and then the line of sight crosses the inner halo at about 2.2 kpc, and there are those stars too, and the problem is to separate all of these things out. And here, of course, the wonderful work that Ivan talked about this morning, we certainly all owe a great debt of gratitude to Ivan for this wonderful pioneering work that he's done on proper motions, and we've picked up with that technique to allow us to separate out these individual components, and that's what I'd like to show you a little bit about. Here's images of M4 taken 6 years apart. Here's what was our original program done in 1995. This is a field far out, 6-core radii. Just like Raja, by the way, these are super sampled images, not 4x4, but they're 3x3 super samples, so we've increased the resolution. The crowding, as you can see, is not very bad at all. Here's a 606 image taken in 2001. And I think it was Raja that showed this. You can certainly see galaxies in the field. You can actually look right through the clusters to the background. But the thing I want to show you is what Ivan talked about this morning, that makes life tractable in this whole problem, and that is that we can separate out the stars. And I want to impress upon you that this is a really easy thing to do. This is not a subtle effect. And just to see it, I'm going to blink these images. You might want to watch this star over here and this star over here. And this is blinking manually. Now you'll see that the faint star doesn't appear to move very much. In fact, it doesn't move at all. And the other star, this one over here, whoops, definitely moves, as does the galaxy. Well, these images were set up so that the thing was zero-pointed on this particular star, which turns out, which is a cluster star. And you can see that very simply we can separate, even just sitting in front of the computer if you really wanted to do it, not a very good way to do it, but even if you wanted to do it, it's easy to separate the cluster stars from the inner halo stars, the background stars in the galaxy. So this is M4 again, a slightly different picture. These are the fields which we observed in M4. We did some in 95, we did some in 2001. We repeated this field with a very, very deep 123 orbit exposure. And I just want to impress upon you that this is about the amount of time that was given to the Hubble Deep Field. So we can, and this is only in two colors. So we can actually talk about this as a globular cluster deep field, and hopefully, as I'll show you, there's lots of new discoveries to be made here. The inner fields overlap quite a bit. If anybody's interested why they overlap, I can explain that in some detail later. But the inner part of the PC field actually projects into about a half a core radius from the cluster center. And Ivan and his group have imaged these about a year or two ago, and that can all be used for proper motion cleaning. So here's the first, this is basically what we published a few months ago. This is the M4 color magnitude diagram, including proper motion cleaning. This is a plot similar to what Ivan showed. These are HST pixels. Here's the inner halo of the galaxy, and here's the cluster. Here's the color magnitude diagram when you use everything. Here's the color magnitude diagram when you just center on the cluster itself. And you can see that a lot of the junk just goes away. Nice clean main sequence and a really quite spectacular white dwarf sequence. And here, and there's a lot of interesting astrophysics here, which I'm not going to talk about very much today, except a little bit about the white dwarfs. This is the color magnitude diagram of the inner halo of the galaxy, and you can get that, you can isolate that by this group of stars over here. So here's a few of the main points that you can get from largely just looking at the diagram. First of all, it's very deep. We get to almost 30th magnitude. The distance modulus of the cluster, in case you're interested, is 12.5. So we're getting down to about an absolute magnitude of 17.5 in the cluster. There's an apparent end of the main sequence, as you can see, at about 27.5. I'm going to have a little bit more to say about that in a moment. But you can actually see, even in this diagram, there is a scatter of stars down to the limit of the data. And I'll have more to say about these in just a moment. The white dwarfs, I won't talk about this in any detail, but there's a very sharp rise in the luminosity function just above 28th magnitude, and that's characteristic of a burst population. When all the stars form simultaneously, that's exactly the kind of luminosity function you expect to see, and that's not what you see in the disk of the galaxy. Brad will talk about this, I think, a little bit more. Very different luminosity function than the disk of the galaxy. There are stars which I know Lars and Dean are interested in, which lie between the main sequence and the white dwarf sequence, a few of these things in here. Possibly some of them are just scattered in by proper motion, but their proper motions are largely very good. So they really do look like cluster members, and potentially these are low mass transfer CVs. It's going to be hard to follow these up because they really are so faint. The halo proper motion, we actually resolve it, and we're working on some papers on that. And we marginally, and I think Ivan's going to do a much better job here, marginally resolve the cluster proper motion. And there's a potential for inner halo white dwarfs down over here, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. So let me first talk about the main sequence, and what do we see? Here's a few of the things we might want to learn something about in this data set. How low does the main sequence go? Do we in fact see the end of the hydrogen burning main sequence in a globular cluster of this metallicity? This is quite a bit more metal-rich than Ivan was talking about this morning in 6397. Do we see evidence for mass segregation if we look at the three fields, four fields? Can we test the models, and what do we know about binary stars here? So let me first address the question of low luminosity stars. Here's a blow-up of the color magnitude diagram down at the faint end. Here's the main sequence, and I've just highlighted in red, I mean the red stars, you might as well put them in red, low luminosity stars down here, and you can see that they really do provide a natural extension to the main sequence. And the thing I want to impress upon you with this diagram here is that these are not outliers in the proper motion distribution. These really do look like cluster members. The interesting thing here is that the faintest luminosity object that you see in the halo of the galaxy in the field is about 27.5. So all of these things, if they are in fact cluster members, and I certainly believe that they do, are significantly less luminous than any field subdwarf that's known in the halo of the galaxy. Now, I think that does not mean that M4 is doing different things in the halo of the galaxy. I think all it means is that we just have a lot more statistics in M4 than you do in the halo of the galaxies. These things are very rare. Yes?
Why didn't you include the black dot next to the red one?
Oh, this one here? Because actually the cut was made in an eye magnitude cut, and it didn't quite pass the cut. Yes, that could be red if you so chose. So I don't, as I said, I don't think that M4 is any different than the halo of the galaxy, just we have better low luminosity statistics in M4 than you have in the halo of the galaxy. And I think if people start looking hard enough, they will find things down at this luminosity in population 2. This is a M sub V of 17.5, by the way. So it's going to be hard to find. Okay, now in terms of the question of have we seen the end of the hydrogen burning main sequence in a globular cluster of this metallicity, again I want to stress this is a lot more metal rich than Ivan was talking about this morning. Here's just, again, pretty much the same diagram. Here's the M4 main sequence. Here's this extent, these very faint luminosity objects. These are Rome models of, these are Rome models in VV minus I, and you can see they don't fit the data very well. This was a discussion we had this morning. What happens in the mass luminosity relationship in these colors is that it stretches out the main sequence enormously. So if you believe the models, the end of the main sequence, the end of the hydrogen burning main sequence in these colors is at about 33rd magnitude. And we're just not going to ever see them with HST. However, there's a real hope here if one goes to the infrared. And this is a very small fraction, about 1% of some Gemini data that we have, which is about a 27-hour exposure in exactly the same field in J and K. So it's only about 1% of the data, that's why it doesn't go very deep. But the interesting thing I want to show to you is, number one, it fits the data much better, so the infrared models do a much better job of fitting the main sequence. And the other thing is, here is really, at least according to the models, where the end of the hydrogen burning main sequence is in these colors. And I think we're going to get this faint, certainly in K, I don't know about K. K is really hard going at this kind of magnitude. But we may have a chance to see the end of the main sequence in J, and possibly even with our I data, our HSD I data.
Harvey, what's a typical V minus K color? Where would the bottom of your main sequence in K translate over to V?
In V?
Yeah. So
V minus I is like roughly 6-7 almost. Say 6 is a rough thing. So V minus I is going to be 6. So V minus K is probably going to be somewhere around... probably going to have to be somewhere like around 9 is what I would guess. Does that look right? Yeah, because it's a 24 in K and it's somewhere around 33rd in V. So V minus K is going to be something like 9.
Do you have some formulation
This is all proper motion cleaned, but it's only been proper motion cleaned with the V and the I data. Yeah. Okay. Now, as I showed you, we have a number of HST fields at different radii, and we have several epochs in these, so we can actually take a look at what the cluster color magnitude diagram and the mass function looks like as a function of radius in M4. And so these are color magnitude diagrams, now proper motion cleaned, in half a core radius out to 1.5, 1.5 to 2.5, 2.5 to 4, and out at about 6 core radii. And the things I want you to just observe is that the binary fraction, just looking at it, I mean, we haven't done the analysis yet for the binary fraction, but you can see just looking that equal mass binaries, it's relatively small, probably no more than a few percent equal mass binaries at any location. We see a well-developed white dwarf population at all positions, and a few interesting objects that are sort of lying between the white dwarfs and the main sequence.
This is equal mass binaries where the primary would be already very low mass.
That's correct. So if you want a mass scale here, this is probably about 2/10 over here, roughly. So this is like probably 2.3 solar mass stars, something in that range. And the other thing which I want to show you now is what the mass function slope looks like as we go from the inner field out to the outer fields. And that's why I was so delighted to see Raj's talk this morning, because we see something which looks very similar, although not quite as dramatic as he sees in 47 Tuck. So here's our distant field at 6 core radii, and the mass function slope is about 0.6 to 0.7. This is alpha now. Okay? So a saltpeter value here is 2.3, so this is very, very much flatter than alpha. And the exponent actually goes negative when we go to the inner field. I'm not sure that these are different. In fact, as you could probably put a straight line through the three of them, but there's no doubt that there's a real difference between what we see at 6 core radii and what we see in the inner parts of the cluster. So this is a mass function which is very high mass weighted in the inner part of the cluster. So I think the conclusion here is that M4 has undergone enormous mass segregation, but not only that, but if the IMF is anywhere near saltpeter, there's been an enormous amount of mass loss from the cluster, unless there's a huge number of low-mass stars sitting way out in the periphery of the cluster. So I think M4 is probably quite heavily dynamically evolved. All right, let me say a few quick words about white dwarfs. We're interested in white dwarfs because we want to know about the property of very cool white dwarfs. This is still of interest for the dark matter question. I mean, is some reasonable fraction of the halo dark matter in cool white dwarfs? The way we're going to know the properties of cool white dwarfs is probably to study them in globular clusters. Of course, we're interested in white dwarf cooling ages. This is a new way to get at globular cluster ages, and we can test both stellar evolution and white dwarf cooling theory. So here's basically a diagram which we published. This is the M4 white dwarf cooling sequence. Again, proper motion clean. These are white dwarf cooling models at half a solar mass for hydrogen in blue and for helium models in red. And these are the 50% completeness limits. And again, I want to stress that the luminosity function is as expected from a burst population. Here's an interesting diagram which overlays field white dwarfs projected to the distance of M4. And there's a number of things which you can see from just looking simply at this diagram. So the dots here are, in fact, all the white dwarfs we've identified in M4. These small dots, in case you're interested, are all the things which didn't look as though they were cluster members based on proper motion. But Brad likes to plot them, so we often include them in the plots anyway. The red the blue dots are hydrogen-rich white dwarfs in the field. These are in the disk of the galaxy. The red dots are helium-rich white dwarfs, and the open circles are white dwarf binaries. So all I want to say from this diagram is you can see that we find many fainter, probably DA, helium hydrogen-rich white dwarfs in the cluster than we see in the disk of the galaxy. So you could conclude from this alone, and this was one of the major conclusions of our paper in a more analytic way, that the globular cluster is significantly older than the disk of the galaxy. And it's not subtle. This is 5 or 6 gigayears older. And the other thing of interest I just want to point out is that there are a number of potential white dwarf binaries at low luminosity in the cluster.
How do you correct the distance for the field
to one dwarf? They have parallaxes.
Known distances.
This is a very selected sample.
That's like an example that is used for the getting the age of the galactic disk.
Okay, what can we say about the cluster mass function and relate it to the white dwarfs? Because we really have a real opportunity here. We can see the white dwarfs and we can see the main sequence and we can relate the two. Here's just a quick, again, a diagram that we published. This is what the mass function looks like. I fit a power line, Guido, excuse me, I just fitted a power law to it, and it's very flat. And again, the value of alpha that we get here is 0.7. Remember, saltpeter is 2.3. Now, what we can do with this is we can make the very simple assumption that this power law continues all the way up to 8 solar masses, which is the most massive star that can produce a white dwarf. Probably a lousy assumption, but bear with me for just a moment. If you do that, if you say, how many stars would this mass function predict above 0.8 solar masses, which is the turnoff mass, so that tells you how many white dwarfs you expect to see, the prediction is we ought to have seen about 1,200 white dwarfs in our field. And the actual number that we see is, in completeness correction, corrected, is about 600. So this is actually a very pleasing number. I mean, they're within a factor of 2, which is more than you might have expected for many reasons. But however, if the slope is about 1, just at the upper end of the uncertainty here, then we can actually reproduce this number very nicely. And in fact, as you would expect the slope, most clusters show a slight steepening in slope as you move upward.
I was just wondering if the 1219 excludes things that are too massive to become white dwarfs.
Yeah, so the 1219 is from 0.8 to 8.
To 8.
So, perhaps a way to look at this is that the mass function slope is somewhere around 1 for this cluster, and that accounts for all the white dwarfs, and we've basically seen all the white dwarfs, and most of them must be hydrogen-rich. Most of them cannot be helium-rich because they would have cooled below our detectability and meant that there's a huge number of helium white dwarfs, which really don't work in the statistics here. So if you're dominated by helium white dwarfs, this whole problem doesn't really work very well. No, I don't believe that this is the IMF, but I'm saying this is a little exercise you can do and to ask the question, is it reasonable that the mass function that I'm seeing here goes all the way up to 8 solar masses?
But if you had saltpeter up to, say, between 1 and 8 solar masses, then how many white dwarfs would you expect?
About 100. Way, way too few. So I think that's the point, Fred. You would predict, if the slope is fairly steep above 0.8 solar masses, you predict way, way too few white dwarfs.
Based on the total number of stars in the cluster today, what's the normalization?
The normalization is what I see from about a tenth of a solar mass up to, this is about 0.6
so
solar masses.
By what you see today.
Today, absolutely.
So this could also be that the cluster did start with a saltpeter mass, but it just lost a large fraction of its
total. But you're not going to lose the heavy stuff. It's the heavy stuff that you're concerned about here, right?
Okay.
So if you've lost a lot of this stuff, you make the problem even worse. Okay? So
isn't that exactly the direction in which the
lambda
motion is going to change the mass function? If something the IMF was steeper.
So if the IMF was steeper earlier on, then it'll depend on what you get based on the normalization down here. I agree. So if you've lost enormous numbers of these things, you could change the normalization. That's true.
Can you tell us quickly how you got your mass function bottom of the uncertainty that we heard about from Guido this morning?
You want the details of how I derived the mass function?
How uncertain is your index here, given the uncertainties from...
The 99% confidence interval is plus or minus 0.3, fitting a power law to the whole thing.
But I thought the main sequence, you know...
In this mass range.
Does it really fit over that whole mass range?
Well, no, of course, it's a, you know, it's a lousy fit, right? I mean, look at the error bars. I mean, I could fit a sine curve better than a straight line, right? Yeah, but... how many would they predict high mass? I don't know the number off the top of my head, but that, of course, would depend on your initial final mass relationship that you use. But it's easy enough to figure out. I mean, if you say that anything above 5 solar masses to 8 solar masses gives you 1.2, you could work it out easy enough. We'll work it out right after. It's not a difficult problem. Let me just mention one last thing just on this, and that is that when the mass function slope is this flat, it really, when you want to do these kind of statistics, it really does matter what you choose for the upper mass limit. If it's 8 solar masses, then you get this. But if you want to just sort of play with numbers a little bit, and you want to make these agree, then you can predict what the upper mass limit would be for white dwarf production. And actually, it turns out to be 3.5 solar masses, which the theoreticians would probably scream about, but observers know that this number is completely, almost completely unconstrained by observations. Okay, two more things that I want to talk about. Variable stars in M4. We did an extensive search for variables. I had a master's student who spent the last 2 years doing this. He now hates me with a passion, and the reason he hates me is this line over here. So we did extensive simulations to try and see what we would expect, and these are our expectations. We found no variables whatsoever, none, not even a supernova in some background galaxy, no planetary occultations. So the implication here is that there's a very low binary fraction, but there's one curious exception. this is the only thing that looked as though it was variable. And I want to just mention that we picked this thing out before we knew anywhere where it was in the in the color magnitude diagram. So here's its light curve in I and in V, and you can see that this is about the worst window function you could have designed for trying to find variable stars, but this program wasn't set up to find variable stars. There's actually a break in the data of about 30 days here. There's sort of an achromatic rise in V and in I of about a tenth of a magnitude. We weren't able to actually measure a period for this thing, but it did look as though it was variable. But what turned out to be interesting, and why I think this is an interesting object, it's in a really goofy location in the color magnitude diagram. There it is. This is also a star. This thing we don't believe as a real position. This thing's near the edge of the frame, so we want to discount that. So this looks as though it's our brightest white dwarf that we see in the globular cluster, but it's not on the white dwarf cooling sequence. It's too red to be on the cooling sequence. So you can play the astronomy 101 game, and you can decompose the variable. And when you decompose it, it gets broken down into a white dwarf, which is the brightest white dwarf that we see in the cluster, and something way down over here at about a tenth of a solar mass, a red main sequence star. And I just want to stress, if anybody wants to discuss this, this is something which one could follow up nicely with Gemini. It's bright enough to get a spectrum of, and it's also bright enough that one could do a proper time series analysis and really see what's going on. So that's a potential object. No, it doesn't work for two white dwarfs at all. It's too... and what? Yeah, so you could, if you want it down, somewhere down here... oh, I see. Okay, I'm almost halfway through my talk. right. Okay, stars in the, I'll do this quickly, stars in the inner halo. For a distance of the Sun from the galactic center of 8 kpc, if we look in this particular direction, we intersect the inner halo at about 2.2 kpc. We can separate these stars, these are of course not the stars, from M4 with proper motions, and we also see galaxies. And this is similar to what Ivan was talking about. We can actually do really nice kinematics using the proper motion technique. So what we want to do is look for inner halo white dwarfs. We may be able to say something about dark matter white dwarfs because we're going very faint toward the center of the galaxy. So if the galaxy is 100%, you know, low luminosity white dwarfs, we may have something to say. And we can also learn something about the kinematics of M4. I'll go through this quickly because Brian's chomping at the bit here. Here's the proper motion diagram again, and now it's in proper galactic coordinates. Here's of course M4. Here's the halo, the inner halo of the galaxy. And what a very clever student of mine did, Jason Kalarai, he went and ran Sextractor, which is an image classifier over all the data, and he found out, picked out the galaxies in our sample. And the red dots are all the things which Sextractor picked out as being galaxies. And they're mostly in over here because they expect to have about zero proper motion. They scatter because, well, it's difficult to measure proper motion of a galaxy when your software thinks it's a star. But the thing that Jason noticed is that there was a concentration of them away from the center of the inner halo clump, and you can see that over here. Here's the color magnitude diagram of everything, and here's the color magnitude diagram of these of the galaxies. And you can see that if you want to say something about inner halo white dwarfs, you better understand which ones are the galaxies. Here's a little bit of nice, this is a color diagram. Again, this is proper motion. These are only white dwarfs in our color magnitude diagram. These are the M4 white dwarfs, and this is everything which is in that inner halo clump. And what Jason noticed was, and this is only colorimetry here, nothing else, there's no science, that this was almost bimodal. There was a group here and this sort of green group over here. But when he overlaid the galaxies on top of that, what he found was the galaxies really concentrated where this green group of proper motion objects were. So what we're saying here is that these objects, even though our software doesn't necessarily tell us that they're galaxies, most of them look as though they're galaxies from Sextractor, and we're going to take this as a zero proper motion frame. And when you do that, and you select out, get rid of the galaxies now, and just look at the things which are not galaxies in that clump of objects, you find this group of red dot objects here, which I've just projected onto an M4 color magnitude diagram, shifted to the galactic center, so I can guide the eye well enough and convince you of what I'm saying. And I think what we're seeing here for the first time is a cooling sequence of white dwarfs in the inner halo of the galaxy. Doesn't go horribly faint because the inner halo is a lot farther away than the globular cluster. And in terms of some statistics, we expect it to be see about 15 of these. We see about 10. These numbers are actually better if we do the incompleteness a little tighter. But the point is, we expected 3 dark matter white dwarfs from the canonical halo dark matter picture. And the statistics are horrible, but we certainly don't see any kind of overwhelming evidence for white dwarfs, dark matter white dwarfs. Okay, last point, and then I'll stop. As Ivan pointed out, we can use the galaxies as the a zero proper motion reference frame in the same way that Ivan used the quasar in one of the other M4 fields. And we can now measure the absolute proper motion of M4, and these are the values that we get. So this allows us then to get the real, honest-to-goodness orbit of the cluster, and that's, I think, very important in studying the dynamics of this thing. And the other thing, which Ivan didn't talk about, but his group has also done, one can also get a very important galactic rotation constant, V0 over R0, and with our data, this is the circular velocity at the distance of of the Sun, we get 27.4 plus or minus 1.9, which for 8 kpc gives us a circular velocity of just over 219. And we received 10 days or so a preprint from Ivan's group from Bedin, and these numbers agree rather nicely, and that's very comforting. So, the summary, and I'm now done, this is the last transparency. Proper motions are critical, and again, we should thank the pioneers for bringing our attention and bringing the attention of the community to this tremendously important technique. And I think we're going to see much more of this, even with ground-based data, in the near future. M4 has lower luminosity stars down the main sequence than it's seen in the field. Again, I don't think this is anything special about M4. I think it's just statistics. It's probably undergone enormous dynamical evolution, and we think we understand the statistics, the white dwarf statistics in M4, pretty well. I think we can say with a lot of confidence that M4 is significantly older than the galactic disk. The binary frequency in M4 is quite low, a few percent, and that's a bit strange. It's not a core collapse cluster. We can measure the absolute proper motion of M4 and hence its orbit, and we can measure galactic rotation. And if you haven't seen enough pictures of M4, here's another one.
Measured for very low mass objects, and even the most elementary considerations of dynamics in a dense cluster would in fact predict that these very low mass objects, even if they were born in a binary system, by now would have become single objects. So this in no way constrains the kind of binary fractions that, you know, are important for dynamical models, because those are, you want to constrain the fraction of binaries that are long-lived in the cluster.
Right. So one of the things one might want to look at, Fred, here is, oh yeah, I have one here. There's two I would project much better, is to look at the white dwarf binaries, the potential ones, and have a hard look at those and see if any of those are potential. Those
also low mass white dwarfs.
Not necessarily, they could be relatively massive white dwarfs. In fact, as they're in a region of the color magnitude diagram where the white dwarfs may be reasonably massive, because they're quite old. Many of them looked as though they were relatively old.
What would be the mass of the most massive white dwarf that you?
Well, again, I don't have an exact number, but they could be upwards of I don't know. I don't have a number for it. So maybe Brad. Brad, you went to the bathroom, Brad, at the critical time. So Fred has asked, what's the most massive binary white dwarf system that we might have seen? Another one's the one that the
massive one, binary.
Well, the potential.
Most massive white dwarfs in the luminosity. It's probably only about 0.7, a little bit above 0.7, at least according to the models. It's going to depend a little bit on whose initial to final mass relation you use. But, I mean, for the purposes of sort of the 1.2 solar mass people are talking about, no way.
For that, we're going to have to look, you know, in great detail in the core for those kind of things.
No, you won't see. Not if they're 12 meters old.
We might see them as binary systems or something.
You know, this is on a different vein. You were giving limits at the end on dark matter white dwarfs. Now, by this, did you mean simply white dwarfs in the halo that might be there in excess
yes.
of the standard galactic
yes.
predictions?
Yes. So the numbers that the numbers, and these numbers are still, I'm afraid, a little bit fluid, but I hate when people do this. Why do I do it? where are we? Okay. Right. So what I mean here is the following. We can estimate the number of inner halo white dwarfs we expect to see. And we did that in two ways, and they sort of agree or don't agree. You can actually just do a galactic structure model and normalize it locally. Or else what you can do, which I which I like a little bit better, you can actually take the observed mass function of the inner halo and play the same game mm-hmm. that I did in the cluster. And here, Fred, of course, you don't have to worry about mass segregation. And then you can predict the number of white dwarfs you expect to see. In other words, mm-hmm. the thing that are above the turnoff from the inner mm-hmm. halo. And that gives us a number, as I said, of order 15 or so. Mm-hmm. That gives us about mm-hmm. 15. And we see the 10 objects here. Now, with the dark matter white dwarfs, this number comes from the following, a 20% halo.
Oh, so you're basically using one of the macho constraints.
That's right.
That was basically going to be the tenor of my question.
No,
what contact
right.
do you make
so
with them?
So it's a 20% uh-huh. halo with 50% of those mm-hmm. hydrogen white dwarfs. Mm-hmm. And that gives you this number of about 3. But you can see, of course, that the statistics are too lousy to really say anything.
Right. Do you have hope? I mean, you're looking in this direction. You had this extremely deep, wonderful observation. If there are a bunch others of these spread around the sky, do you anticipate that you might be able to start putting these kinds
well,
of limits?
Well, I think you're going to do better from the ground with very wide angle deep surveys than you're going to do with HST. So we have a program going now at CFHT, Peter Stetson's the lead on that, where we're doing 15 squared degrees of sky to 25th magnitude. And we have two epochs already separated by about 2 years, and we're getting a third epoch. And I think that'll give us a better result than trying to grind away with HST in these little tiny fields. Even we get a lot more volume from the ground. No, this is a survey which we've been doing for 3 years now.
Yes, there's more a comment. I mean, you said you chose 8 solar masses as the maximum mass for white dwarf formation. I don't think that number is so sacrosanct because I mean, it has been used for 20 years, but we know now that there's much more convective overshooting in these stars, which should bring that number down.
Right.
Moreover, it should also be metallicity dependent for general reasons, so you would expect it to be lower in low metallicity systems.
Well, if you want 3.5, I can give it to you.
Well, I might be.
No, okay. I agree, Philip. I mean, the observational constraints on that are really very poor. That's, in fact, the thesis project of a student of mine where we're doing a big.
It'd be good to know what that number is.
Right. Unfortunately, we're doing it in open clusters, so it's all going to be solar metallicity. We're not going to get the metallicity dependence.
The right hand of the back. And what are the prospects for Pollux spectroscopy
on these systems? And so try to nail down some of the masses of these white dwarf systems.
Actually, okay. So subtract 3.2, and this gives you the distance of these things from. So the white dwarf sequence starts roughly at about 23rd magnitude. So you can do about a magnitude of this or so with the 8-meter class telescopes from the ground. I don't think that's particularly interesting. I mean, it doesn't cover much of a range. I mean, I think it's important to do. In fact, there's a couple of spectra in the literature. Sabine Moeller had some VLT spectra that came out in the literature. Well, and they were spectacular, down at 24th magnitude. It was just a conference proceeding, but I think the signal-to-noise must have been enough to get spectroscopic gravities on this thing, but they certainly look like that. And so they'll tell you what the masses of these things are. But, you know, they're going to be between 0.5 and 0.6, so it's not going to be very interesting. Spectroscopically, you know, we're just not going to do good spectra down at 30th magnitude, even with NGST. So it's hard. Brad may have more to say about all of that.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is that I think with the rather large overlap between your two proper motion distributions, the faintest stars that you attribute to the main sequence are not inconsistent with the hypothesis that they're all field stars that happen to fall within the rather large circle that you drew for cluster stars. I'd like to follow this up with our proper motions, in which the circle will have a tenth of the area or less, and see what those stars are. The question is,
well, let me make a comment on that, Ivan. First of all, I mean, do appreciate that these objects are at 30th magnitude. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two is, it's not that we're just measuring their positions on the 123 orbit exposure. We're also measuring them on the 7,000 second first epoch.
That's what my question was about. Since you didn't have 123 orbits, how did you measure stars that are so faint?
Right. So the answer to that is actually interesting. We spent a lot of time thinking about that. And the answer is several-fold. Number one, you don't need as good... The proper motions are large. They're not. It's not a subtle effect. If it was a subtle effect, it would be hard, but the proper motions are large. So you don't need as good signal-to-noise to do the astrometry as you want for the photometry. So that's number one. The second thing is, the way Stetson's software works is that if you know where the stars are, approximately where they are, you can almost always measure them. And that's the bit of gold that happened here. So the finding lists are always made on the very long exposures. And then we use that finding list on the shorter exposures. And more often than not, we can find these objects. It's actually a very interesting result.
Javi, just a comment on your comment and Ivan's comment. Could you stick the red dots up again? Because that's not strictly the way we actually did it, the way you showed it. I mean, the way we actually... located those stars, or convinced ourselves that those stars were in fact cluster members, is you make the color magnitude diagram cut first. So you say that's the area we're interested in. We plot the proper motion distribution for all, or displacements for all of the objects in that region of the color magnitude diagram. And there was a, whereas Harvey's actually plotted everything. If you plot just those guys around that region there, background, cluster, and everything, there's a very clear two clumps. For instance, we didn't make the same argument about that mess of black points to the left of the red, because we tried the same argument there, and there's no real separation into two clumps when you do the same operation. So it is slightly different than the way it's actually presented there.
We have to stop at this point. In fact, you have to continue.